I guess, what is the point of talking to them? And then again, how do you have peace if you don't?
Well, unfortunately, to be honest, in any big conflicts, you talk to the terrorist, you talk to the enemy, you talk to the killer.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. President Trump has been touting his election slogan that he's going to bring U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by Christmas. But as usual, Trump is not the king of clarity. Troops came home long ago, most of them. There aren't very many there, just a few thousand to train the Afghan army and also key air assets to support operations. The U.S. at one point had 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. The Obama administration reduced it to about 5,500. Funny enough, in 2017, Trump criticized President Obama for making pronouncements about troop drawdowns in Afghanistan.
We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities. Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on. America's enemies must never know our plans or believe they can wait us out.
Anyway, that's politics for you. Right now, there are peace talks with the Taliban to stop dreadful attacks across that country. But they keep occurring. So is there really the chance of peace in that poor country that has been through so much? And I've been there a lot. I was one of the first ones to cross into Afghanistan after 9/11 from Tajikistan. And I've been back and forth into Afghanistan as a correspondent a couple of dozen times. On Backstory, Afghan Peace Prospects. Coming up, we talk to the former Canadian ambassador to Afghanistan, Chris Alexander. But first, the Afghan ambassador to the UK, who has been so kind to discuss the current challenges. All right, I want to introduce you to Saib Tayyab Jawad. He is the serving ambassador to the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, representing Afghanistan. Hello, sir.
Good morning.
From December 2003 to 2010, you were also the ambassador to the United States, I should mention, and you were also the chief of staff to the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai. You have a lot of experience in terms of watching what's been happening in Afghanistan.
Yes, I've been serving in different capacities in Afghan governments, basically since 9/11, since 2002.
It's amazing to see, as peace talks are underway with the Taliban, so-called peace talks, this relentless violence. I mean, rockets fired, a car bomb, attempts by the Taliban to take Lashkar Gah in Helmand province. Is this the road to peace?
Well, the good news is that the peace talk has started. That's a good, it's a good beginning after 30, 40 years of violence. The fact that we are sitting across the table, it is a progress. And the fact that it's been 30 and 40 years of the violence, we expect some glitches, we expect some delays. We don't think that's going to be an easy road. And we want to be realistic about what we expect. It's going to be a difficult road. It's going to be a long road. And it's going to be difficult to manage the expectations of the Afghan people, who really deserve peace, demand peace, but we have to come actually into an agreement with the enemy, also with the Taliban, to what kind of setup will emerge from the peace talks.
What is the point of talking to the Taliban? I mean, they initially they were directly tied into Al-Qaeda. Then they said they weren't, but they've been operating in conjunction with the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence agencies, launching relentless, endless attacks. I guess, what is the point of talking to them? And then again, how do you have peace if you don't?
Well, unfortunately, to be honest, in any big conflicts, you talk to the terrorist, you talk to the enemy, you talk to the killer. That's what happened. And then big peace processes and in Colombia and in Northern Ireland and other places. It is a necessity. The bloodshed has gone for too long. There is a strong consensus in the Afghan society. And there's also some regional encouraging move by Pakistan and other and pressure by the United States to end the conflict. It's not going to be easy. I wish either we had the force to take him out completely and impose actually an Afghanistan that we envision for the future of our country That's not possible. The peace process is due to the fact that we, the Afghan government and the Taliban, are mutually weak. We have to find a solution other than trying to eliminate each other.
I mean, in Northern Ireland, to use your example, there was an armed wing and there was a political wing. Supposedly, at the end of it, you could separate them. The political wing spoke about peace. They demanded that the armed wing give up their arms for different things like prisoner releases and all that. Can you make that differentiation with the Taliban? Is there an armed Taliban, an armed wing, and a political wing? I don't think there is.
You're absolutely right. There was in the conflict in Northern Ireland had a religious or ideological basis. There are some specific demands on what they wanted to accomplish. Same thing in many other in Sri Lanka or other places. The challenge of the peace process in Afghanistan is that the Taliban have not providing an alternative on what do they want if they don't agree what we are offering actually as part of the system of governance.
What do you think they want?
We don't know. And again, we can judge what they were actually when they were an Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan. And that's not actually a very attractive model of governance for the Afghan people or for the rest of the world, in fact. So they have to... Part of the peace process is to make Taliban actually to come with specific proposal on not only saying that they don't like what the Afghan people or the Afghan government is doing, it's specifically what is their plans. Like, for instance, what is their plan on the higher education, for example? No higher education at all, or no higher education for girls, or no higher education in separate institutions. They have never actually come up with specific plans and idea on not only on governance, but also on healthcare, on education, on providing services. And it's part of the peace process is to make them think and put forward some plans on how they envision the future of Afghanistan with them being part of the Afghan society.
Can you have peace with the Taliban? I mean, never mind all the complications of, you know, who the Taliban are. And I don't believe that I think they want power. I don't think they want peace. But can you make peace with the Taliban while the Pakistani government continues to stir Afghanistan and continues to push the Taliban out, push Al-Qaeda out, maybe ISIS as well?
Our peace efforts is multi-pronged. We are talking to Taliban is the main enemy, actually, that is will be an important player in bringing the peace. But also, we are trying to convince Pakistan as our neighbor, Iran, and other that a stable, peaceful, and pluralistic, more important, pluralistic Afghanistan is something that will be in the best interest of them too. And that's, we think that only a pluralistic republic in Afghanistan can accommodate the diversity of the Afghan society, but also the competing interests around Afghanistan. You're absolutely right. Pakistan has different interests than India, and both of them are important friends or neighbors of us. Iran and Saudi Arabia are competing on many platforms. But we are trying to make them understand that a peace and stability in Afghanistan and a pluralistic system in Afghanistan is not only the demand of the Afghan people, but also to the best interest of these countries.
My next question is going to be a bit long just because I think I have to give a bit of background. But essentially, at one point after 9/11, there were 100,000 American forces in Afghanistan, plus all the ISAF, the NATO allies that joined in there, Canada, Britain, France, everybody. That now we're talking, we only have 5,500 U.S. soldiers in there. President Trump has said he's going to bring them home by Christmas, which is a very good kind of election slogan. But is that a good thing to do? Do you want American troops to leave, or do you want it to be condition-based, like General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said, okay, stop the fighting, Taliban, put your arms down, stop fighting, and then condition-based, yes, then we'll take the rest of our troops out. How do you think it should go?
We think that the war in Afghanistan is a war against terrorism. It's not only for the stability of Afghanistan, it's for the stability of the region and for safety and security of the world. We saw that after the Soviets withdraw and the international forces and the international support actually also withdraw from Afghanistan. The result of that was emergence of fanatic groups in the region and Al-Qaeda, which was a result of actually of the resistance group against the Soviets. So we as Afghan, we are ready to defend Afghanistan. Most of the war now is conducted by Afghans. Fortunately, there are no foreign soldiers being killed in Afghanistan, and that's a good thing. We appreciate the services that the foreign soldiers have provided to Afghanistan, as you mentioned, not only United States, but many of our NATO allied and non-NATO partners that was part of this fight.
True, non-NATO as well.
We're very grateful for that, but they have enabled us now by their training, by their resources. We are conducting the fight ourselves. We would like them to stay in Afghanistan in supporting role. Give us the intelligence enabler, give us the training and the equipments. We will conduct the war ourselves. But also, we think that the war has international security impact, and therefore, unresponsible withdrawal from Afghanistan without considering the condition on the ground, or making the withdrawal based on the political convenience of a person instead of the national interest of the United States, is a risky move. We would like them to reconsider, because we think the best national interest of the United States, of the NATO country in Afghanistan, coincide in working together to making sure that Afghanistan will not become a source of instability for Afghans, for the region, or a source of support for terrorism in the world.
The UN came out in June and said that the Taliban retain close ties to Al-Qaeda. This is where this all started after 9/11, when the Taliban were asked to give up Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Do you believe they are still retaining close ties to Al-Qaeda? And by allowing the Taliban to take some form of power in Afghanistan, don't you allow Al-Qaeda back? And I know that they're still there.
Well, of course, it's not only the history of Taliban and Al-Qaeda working together, but also the ideological bond between the two of them are very strong. That's why we have not seen any public statement by the Taliban leadership actually denouncing Al-Qaeda. Our American friends are saying to us that they have done it privately, but if it is an honest stand, they should come out publicly and denounce actually any affiliations with the groups like Al-Qaeda or others, new international terrorist group that operate in or around Afghanistan. So we have our doubt that they will take a strong stand. We will definitely are very suspicious of the idea that making them a tool or a mean of fighting other terrorist group in Afghanistan, is it sometime told by our American friends. We don't think this is going to work. And if it works, it will be repeating the mistakes of the Cold War.
Ambassador, where do we go from here? I know that the talks are continuing and the violence is continuing. My final question to you, is this going to play out over weeks, months, years? How is this going to go, do you think? I know it's hard to tell.
If you look at the peace processes in Colombia, where I served as ambassador, and I know that country, other places, Northern Ireland or Sri Lanka, many other conflict areas, usually you're talking in a term of years, unfortunately. As much as we want this conflict to end as soon as possible, as much as the Afghan people would like to see an immediate stop of bloodshed, the negotiation will last. That's why what we are asking for is a serious reduction of violence and also a ceasefire on both sides. Because a ceasefire will give confidence to the Afghan people that this talk is going somewhere. It's very hard for us to sell the idea of the peace to Afghans while dozens of people are getting killed on the street every day. And it's same thing is also on the side of the Taliban. If they are encouraging their young man to wear suicide belts and don't go out and fight and carry jihad, how are they going to convince them to step down and live actually as a normal citizen? That process should start. That process of serious reduction of violence and a ceasefire. And even if the talks continue for months or years on for us to agree on the form of the political setup that emerged, that's fine. But the immediate demand is a ceasefire and an end to bloodshed.
And again, you would say to a President Trump or President Biden, whatever the case, stay with us until the ground-based conditions of an end to the violence are tangible.
Absolutely, yes.
Ambassador, thank you so much, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right, I want to take you to Toronto now and introduce you to Chris Alexander. He was Canada's Minister of Citizenship and Immigration from 2013 to 2015. He spent 18 years in Canada's Foreign Service, and he served abroad in places like Moscow. And then he became, I think, Canada's youngest ambassador in Kabul, Afghanistan. You were the youngest ambassador, Chris, is that right?
I guess I was the youngest one at the time, yeah, but there have been other people before and since.
Well, you still look. You still look youthful despite serving in a tough place, So good on you. Look, let's talk about Afghanistan, because you spent years there, not only as the ambassador, but you were also there with the UN. Do you believe in the so-called peace process?
I believe in a peace process, absolutely. And we worked for it, Dana, as Canadians and then in the UN mission for all my time there. We wanted to bring the two sides to the table. We wanted to end the conflict, but we wanted to do it under a constitution and a rule of law and a political system that Afghans had chosen. And we wanted to do it in a way that ended violence. And I would say that both of those conditions are now in doubt. The way the peace process has gone over the last 10 years, and particularly in the last year, as this desperate effort, I would call it, by Ambassador Khalilzad, who's moved forward to sit down with the Taliban at any cost, even as they continue to engage in violence on an alarming scale.
Well, Ambassador Khalilzad is being driven by President Trump, who wants to fly the flag, it seems, and say, I'm bringing the troops home. I mean, there aren't that many there to begin with, but he wants to say for election purposes, by November, he's going to bring them all home or maybe leave 2,500 there into next year. And it seems like that's very short horizon politics, given the tremendous cost that America has had on the ground in Canada, too. Canadian troops were in there as part of ISAF and the NATO element. But this tremendous cost that the Americans have paid, even in blood, being in Afghanistan since 2001.
Yeah. I mean, Trump doesn't care about the outcome for Afghans. He cares only about saving his own skin politically and doing the right thing from a very superficial populist standpoint. He's bought into this rhetoric of forever wars that we could never win. He's an isolationist, and he's anti-NATO, he's anti-alliance. He doesn't think, he thinks the US should have a huge military budget. He doesn't think the US should do anything with its soft and hard power to make the world a safer place for everyone. And so it's a disaster. His rush for the exit without any binding obligation on the part of the Taliban to end the violence. And so they haven't ended the violence.
And that's really put even his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in a very uncomfortable position, right? Because they have said that any withdrawal of American forces will be condition-based, meaning end the violence, and I want to ask you about that, end your ties with Al-Qaeda, and that's where all of this started after 9/11. And then all of a sudden, Trump came out and said, you know, we're gonna be bringing them home by Christmas. And then General Mark Milley had to kind of say, well, wait a moment, this is condition based, and we'll see if the Taliban meet these conditions of stopping the violence. I mean, so there is a contradiction between what the President of the United States is saying and what is Chairman of the Joint Chiefs is saying.
Correct, but let's be clear: this issue of military people insisting a heavier footprint was required and presidents resisting has a long history. I mean, even in George W. Bush's time, the brass were calling for a larger commitment. The White House resisted because Iraq was their priority disastrously. Then under Obama, who came into office promising a surge, he made the surge conditional on starting to pull troops out almost immediately, which most military leaders didn't agree with. And now Trump has taken it further. I mean, here, the real issue, Dana, is very simple, as far as I'm concerned. Yes, a military commitment is still needed. Yes, NATO needs to be there, principally in a training role. Yes, the Afghans need to be enabled to defend their own country. But they will only succeed, and we will only be on a path to peace when someone, somewhere, does something about the fact that the neighboring country, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, bankrolls the Taliban, harbors the Taliban, arms the Taliban, funds the Taliban, trains the Taliban, and sends them across the border to destabilize, undermine, and lay waste to a neighboring country.
But you really make it sound, Chris, like the Taliban's completely behind, that Pakistan is completely behind the Taliban. And I mean, a lot of people would say that they gave them safe haven or allowed them to exist in the frontier area. Are you saying it went much, much, much further?
It still goes much, much further. Why, when Khalilzad is worried about getting the Taliban to the table, does he go bleeding cap in hand to the chief of the army staff in Pakistan? Why do they have to bring him to Kabul and roll out the red carpet and serve him tea on a silver platter to try and get even the Taliban to show up in Doha? It's because Pakistan controls all of the cards as long as the international community is completely inconsistent in its insistence on pressuring the Afghans to negotiate peace while their neighboring country wants to make war. Listen, Russia invaded Ukraine. We sanctioned them. Iran is waging war in three or four countries. Most countries have sanctioned them for that. China has shut down democracy in Hong Kong. We are all changing our relations with China as a result. Pakistan invades Afghanistan every day via the Taliban, has fought NATO for 10 years via the Taliban, and there are no sanctions whatsoever against these people. That is...
Well, in fact, we were giving a lot of money to Pakistan. The Americans failure. Were giving a lot of money to Pakistan.
Well, we've cut back on the money, and they are at least being questioned about their state sponsorship of terrorism through the Financial Action Task Force and a few other venues, but there's been no concerted effort to come to grips with Pakistan's role in fueling this conflict. And as long as that, as we ignore that, this conflict will continue.
Why is Iran now supporting the Taliban as well? Traditionally, they were, not arm in arm with the Taliban. Now there are a lot of reports that Iran, as well as Pakistan, as well as Russia, have their fingers in Afghanistan, but Iran specifically because they believe that the Taliban will push back ISIS, which, has a foothold in a number of provinces.
No, but let's be honest. Iran will maintain relations with any group that is prepared to challenge the United States, particularly with violence. They hosted the leadership of Al-Qaeda partly after 9/11. They have had their own relations with ISIS in the Middle East and elsewhere when they needed to, when it suited them. And with the Taliban, they've always, ever since the Taliban began their comeback in earnest in 2006, they've always had their finger in the pie, but it's a much smaller share of the support than Pakistan has.
They're stirring a lot less trouble there than Pakistan has. Indeed.
They like the Taliban because they're on an upswing in Afghanistan and they're anti-American. They do not like, generally, violent Sunni extremists who have fought them in Iraq, Baluchistan, and elsewhere.
So, Chris, let's roll the clock back a little bit because there's a generation of people don't understand what the hell we're doing in Afghanistan anyway. But, I mean, originally the Taliban were asked to cut their ties with Osama bin Laden after 9/11 and to cut all its ties with al-Qaeda and essentially give up al-Qaeda. And they refused. Mullah Omar refused in Kandahar. And then the invasion began after that under President George Bush. Now the UN has come out in June and said that the Taliban retained close ties to al-Qaeda despite an agreement with America that Washington hoped would see Afghan militants turn their backs on the terrorist group, according to the United Nations Monitor. So after all of this fighting to oust al-Qaeda, and make sure that Afghanistan's not being used as a base for terrorist attacks all over the world. Suddenly the UN, and you were part of the UN, you tell me if you consider that to be a credible report, are saying that the Taliban are maintaining those ties with Al-Qaeda.
I have always fought the people in the UN and elsewhere who thought that the idea of breaking Taliban ties with Al-Qaeda and with terrorism was feasible. It's not. The Taliban is a terrorist group. The Haqqani organization within the Taliban has been a virulently terrorist group, killing civilians at an alarming rate for a decade now in Afghanistan and more. They have received a huge amount of funding from Pakistan's ISI precisely because of their capacity to mete out violence indiscriminately. So it's no surprise that all of these people have links to Al-Qaeda, that Osama bin Laden, after 9/11, after the U.S. Operation began in Afghanistan, took refuge in Pakistan and was there for over a decade, living in comfort near Abbottabad as a guest of the Pakistani government. And anyone who thinks that that is not the case, that Pakistan was tough on Al-Qaeda and not on the Taliban, that Pakistan doesn't really want terrorists to be based on their country, should have their heads examined, because the facts are completely otherwise. And the fact that there isn't investigative journalism left and right, backwards and forwards, covering all of this, is amazing to me. I mean, think of Steve Call's book on the S Directorate of the ISI about their involvement in Afghanistan. This is a guy who wrote Ghost Wars in the wake of, and had great success in the wake of 9/11 with it, basically downplaying Pakistan's involvement. Now, over a decade later, he published a book saying, oh, it's all Pakistan's fault, and no one pays attention.
If you're calling...
How do we expect to have any success in the world when we haven't told the truth about what's happening?
You sound angry.
I am angry.
Is that because, I mean, Canadians also policed some of the toughest terrain in southern Afghanistan, and many Canadians...
I'm sad for the families of Canadians who lost their lives there or who were injured there, who've come back with PTSD. The only way you can justify those sacrifices is by being able to say we were on the right path and we got a result. We're not on the right path and we won't get a result. And there are thousands more Americans who lost their lives, thousands more from other NATO countries. And Dana, most of all, there are tens of thousands of Afghans who lost their lives, as well as hundreds of thousands, millions who live in fear in a fragile, in some respects, failed state because we haven't gotten the job done.
Most Afghans, I mean, I entered Afghanistan right after 9/11. I was one of the first journalists across the border from Tajikistan. Most Afghans that I met wanted the Americans to push the Taliban out. They had had enough of them. And for kids to go back to school,
they
for
did. The economy. And they expected the Taliban would not come back. They did not anticipate that Pakistan would help them mount this comeback, which they have done. And they certainly didn't expect that the United States and other allies would, when Pakistan did this, pretend it wasn't happening.
So are we making a mistake by talking to them? Because you're calling them a terrorist organization.
We shouldn't bother talking to the Taliban. We should talk to Pakistan and we should say, you drop these guys, you drop the fight in Afghanistan, or we sanction the hell out of you.
All right. Well, the ISI, which is the intelligence agency of Pakistan, and isn't about to create that kind of peaceful playing field, I think, but maybe sanctions, maybe there is an argument for sanctions.
It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter at all what they think. This is what they're doing. And the consequences for any other country would be sanctions and international isolation. We should be consistent and bring the same principles to the table with them that we bring to any other state that is causing trouble on this scale. And it's incomprehensible to me why we haven't done it yet.
A lot of people would say that Chris Alexander's paints a very bleak picture that unless you talk to the Taliban, this fighting is endless. And we've already got 20 years of it.
Yeah. The Taliban do not call the shots. Ask anyone who knows the organization. Their bosses are in general headquarters, in ISI headquarters. They do not take decisions autonomously. They never have. This is what a proxy war is, Dana. And yeah, you can keep carrying water for Pakistan and saying, oh, you have to talk to the Taliban. They're their own people. But that's actually bullshit.
Where does this end now? If America pulls most of its troops out, or they go down to numbers that are so small that they won't be able to carry any kind of counter-terrorism out in Afghanistan anymore.
In a worst-case scenario, it ends with a U.S. withdrawal and a Taliban takeover.
You think we're really heading back to that?
Being delighted that they have pulled this off.
Unbelievable if they go back to that. It will be a massive failure.
It will be our failure.
Chris Alexander, good to talk to you again. Always great to see you. And, you know, folks, there's not very many people who have the knowledge that Chris has in Afghanistan. He spent a lot of time on the ground. So it's an honor to talk to you. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thanks, Dana. All the best.
And that's our backstory on Afghanistan. The Americans and the Afghan government have to get this right. Political expediency is dangerous for people who have put their trust in a new Afghanistan, which deserves the unwavering support, I think, of the international community. It really does. I'm Dana Lewis. Please subscribe to our podcast and share the link. Wherever you listen to podcasts, Backstory with Dana Lewis is available, and we appreciate you listening and subscribing and signing up for more. Take care. I'll talk to you again soon.